From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My study shows that the Veterans Administration is simply overwhelmed by the large number of soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they are having a very difficult time coping with the volume of disability claims and providing health care, particularly mental health care, to the hundreds of thousands of soldiers returning right now.
Veterans' medical costs, veterans from Iraq, could cost $660 billion. We'll look at the hidden costs of the Iraq War, then the Occupation Project. A new campaign targets lawmakers who refuse to pledge to vote against additional war funding. We'll speak with Kathy Kelly. She's one of 10 peace activists arrested yesterday for occupying Senator John McCain's office. And we'll look at presidential candidate Barack Obama.
Mr. President, when it comes to the war in Iraq, the time for promises and assurances, for waiting and for patience is over. Too many lives have been lost, too many billions of dollars have been spent for us to trust the president on another tired and failed policy.
We'll speak with two journalists closely following Barack Obama's career. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans have managed to block the Senate from voting on a non-binding resolution opposing President Bush's escalation of war in Iraq. The resolution would have marked the first effort by Congress in 4 years to confront President Bush over the war. This is Democratic Senator and presidential candidate Joseph Biden.
If the president does not listen to the majority of Congress and the majority of the American people, we will have to look for other ways to turn this surge around. Even if we succeed in this effort, we still need to turn our overall policy around. We need a strategy that can produce a political settlement, and that's the only way to stop the Shiites and the Sunnis from killing each other and allow our troops to leave Iraq at an appropriate time without trading a dictator for chaos.
Senator Joseph Lieberman joined with Republicans in filibustering the measure. Republicans Susan Collins of Maine and Norm Coleman of Minnesota switched sides and voted with the Democrats. Both Collins and Coleman are up for re-election in 2008. An Iranian diplomat has been kidnapped in Baghdad. An Iranian government spokesperson said the diplomat, Jalal Sharafi, was seized by gunmen linked to the Iraqi Defense Ministry. Iran condemned the kidnapping and said it held the United States responsible for his life. Iraqi officials earlier said the gunmen were wearing uniforms of the Iraqi 36th Commando Battalion, a special Iraqi unit under U.S. direction. The diplomat was seized Sunday night outside the Baghdad branch of an Iranian state-owned bank. Last month, U.S. forces arrested five Iranians during a pre-dawn raid on the Iranian consulate in Erbil in northern Iraq. President Bush recently authorized U.S. troops in Iraq to kill or capture Iranian agents deemed to be a threat. At least 74 people died in Iraq Monday. This comes as Iraqi troops are setting up new checkpoints in Baghdad as part of a campaign to pacify the city following a week that saw over 1,000 people dead. On Monday, President Bush said he sees good signs coming out of Iraq.
I appreciate the fact that the Iraqi government is anxious to get security inside the capital of their country. It's a good sign. It's a good sign that there's a sense of concern and anxiety. It means that the government understands they have a responsibility to protect their people. And we want to help them.
The British newspaper The Sun has obtained video purportedly showing a U.S. pilot mistakenly bombing a British tank convoy in the early days of the war. A 25-year-old British soldier named Matty Hull died in the bombing. The video was purportedly taken from the cockpit of the U.S. jet. The Bush administration classified the video as secret in an attempt to prevent its broadcast or from it ever being used in court. Meanwhile, the British death toll in Iraq has reached 100. A British soldier died Monday in a roadside bombing in Basra. In other Iraq news, CNN has revealed a man once sentenced to death in Kuwait for the 1983 bombings of the U.S. and French embassies now sits in Iraq's parliament. The man, Jamal Jafar Mohammed, is a member of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's ruling coalition. U.S. military officials are accusing him of being an Iranian agent and a supporter of Shiite death squads. In Washington, President Bush sent his $2.9 trillion budget proposal to Congress Monday. If approved, the budget will bring defense spending to levels not seen since the Reagan administration. Bush is seeking over $700 billion for the Pentagon, as well as for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee.
The president's proposal, if adopted as presented, would take us right over the cliff into a chasm of debt. The president, over the long term, his proposals would just put us awash in red ink.
The military funding request is greater than the annual gross domestic product of all but 14 countries. President Bush defended his budget proposal.
Our priority is to protect the American people. And our priority is to make sure our troops have what it takes to do their jobs. We also have got priorities in national parks and education and health care. But we have proven, and I strongly believe Congress needs to listen to, a budget which has no tax increase and a budget because of fiscal discipline that can be balanced in 5 years.
President Bush's budget also calls for about $80 billion in cuts from Medicare and Medicaid programs over the next 5 years. Other programs facing budget cuts include Head Start, the low-income home energy assistance program, and funding for housing for low-income seniors. Critics also say the president's funding request for the Children's Health Insurance Program falls far short of what is needed to keep covering the 6 million children now in the program. Meanwhile, President Bush has asked for a 12% increase in foreign aid. Israel is slated to remain the biggest recipient of U.S. aid with $2.4 billion budgeted for next year. President Bush's budget also calls for more money to expand government propaganda broadcasts into North Korea, Iran, and Cuba. On Capitol Hill, the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform is holding 4 days of hearings this week to examine waste, fraud, and abuse within the government. Today, former Ambassador Paul Bremer will be questioned about the reconstruction of Iraq and mistakes he made as head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. On Wednesday, the House panel will examine the Pentagon's reliance on private military contractors. The United Nations has decided to close all its schools in Gaza because of ongoing violence between the Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah. About 200,000 children attend schools run by the United Nations Works and Relief Agency for Palestine refugees. The BBC is reporting Saudi authorities are remaining tight-lipped about the identities of 10 men arrested Friday on suspicion of funding insurgents outside the country. A defense lawyer says the men are reformists with no links to terrorism. In the past, the 10 signed petitions condemning violence and calling for political reform in Saudi Arabia. In Oaxaca, Mexico, tens of thousands of protesters and teachers marched over the weekend to show support for the ongoing popular resistance against the local government. Marchers called for Governor Ulises Ruiz to resign and for the release of all political prisoners, including Flavio Sosa, a leader of APO, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca. This is Martin Orozco, a teacher in Oaxaca. On Capitol Hill, 10 peace activists were arrested Monday after occupying the offices of Senator John McCain of Arizona. The activists tried to meet with one of McCain's aides, but were denied. The activists sang the names of 75 service members from Arizona who have died in Iraq. The action was part of the newly launched Occupation Project. Activists plan to occupy the offices of lawmakers who refused to pledge to vote against additional war funding. The court-martial of First Lieutenant Aaron Watada is continuing today in Washington State. Watada is the first commissioned officer in the country to publicly refuse deployment to Iraq. On Monday, the judge, Lieutenant Colonel John Head, reinforced an earlier ruling that Watada cannot base his defense on his contention that the Iraq war is illegal. In political news, former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has taken the next step to running for the Republican nomination for president. On Monday, he filed a statement of candidacy with the Federal Election Commission. Meanwhile, Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich has reintroduced a bill in the House to establish a Department of Peace and Nonviolence. In France, the farmer and activist José Bové has announced plans to run for in the country's upcoming presidential election.
J'ai décidé I have decided to accept that my name be added to the election ballot as part of a unified battle against the right and to give new hope as an alternative left.
José Bové has been a leading critic of genetically modified crops and corporate globalization. In education news, Emory University in Georgia has announced that the Dalai Lama will become a distinguished professor at the school. Over the weekend, the Tibetan spiritual leader spoke at a three-day international symposium on Buddhism in India.
Buddhist faith must come from analytical meditation. Analyze, using our intelligence maximum way, to that way faith should come. Not just a blind faith, faith without reason.
The Dalai Lama at Emory University. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new study from Harvard University reports the hidden financial costs of war in Iraq and Afghanistan will overwhelm the Department of Veterans Affairs for decades. The study is called Soldiers Returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, The Long-Term Costs of Providing Veterans Medical Care and Disability Benefits. It finds the Veterans Administration is both underfunded and under-equipped to deal with the current and future costs of veterans' health care. The study estimates since the global war on terror began, 16 U.S. soldiers have been wounded per fatality, a casualty rate that exceeds the rate of previous wars. Over 200,000 soldiers deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan have been treated at VA medical facilities thus far, with 900,000 still deployed on active duty. The study predicts the cost of medical care and compensation benefits for returning veterans will skyrocket once those troops return home. It also estimates the cost over the soldiers' lives will amount to up to $700 billion. The author of the study, Professor Linda Bilmes, joins me now from Cambridge. Professor Bilmes is former Assistant Secretary of Commerce in the Clinton administration, a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Bilmes.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Lay out what you have found, what you were most surprised by in this study.
Well, what I was trying to do was to understand the how prepared the Veterans Administration is to cope with the large influx of soldiers who are returning from the war. And what we found was that the VA is really overwhelmed by the sheer volume of returnees on three dimensions. First of all, in terms of the disability claims, see, when soldiers come back who have been injured or down the road suffer some kind of problem or a problem was exacerbated by being over there, they can claim for a certain amount of disability payment. And right now the Veterans Administration has a backlog of 400,000 pending claims, many of them even from previous wars. So they really are not prepared to cope with a large influx of additional claims. Secondly, the care provided by the VA is very good, but many veterans are having to go onto long waiting lists, particularly for mental health care, because such a very large number of veterans have been seeking help for mental health conditions. And thirdly, the cost of providing care, good quality care, to the veterans will range from a minimum of $350 billion to nearly $700 billion, depending on the length of the war and the percentage of veterans who seek care through the VA. Now, the way that I conducted the study, which I think was very conservative, was I looked back at the first Gulf War, and we found that 44% of the veterans from that war, even though it was a very short war, and there were not many casualties, that 44% are receiving disability claims today. In fact, the government pays $4 billion per year to veterans of the first Gulf War in 91. And secondly, that 48%, nearly half of those veterans, are using the VA healthcare facility. So my study simply looked at what would happen if we had the same rate of claims as we had after the first Gulf War.
Yesterday on Democracy Now!, Linda Vilmas, we reported that the Pentagon is being accused of undercounting the number of troops injured in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you looked at the Pentagon's website last month, it would have appeared that about 47,000 soldiers had been injured in the two wars. But now the figure on the website has dropped to less than 32,000. And the Pentagon is no longer including troops who suffered what it considers minor injuries or mental illness. Can you talk about this?
Well, it's a very strange situation, really. When I was doing my study, I was trying to understand what the cost would be to the Veterans Administration of providing disability and medical care. And obviously, if a soldier is wounded, whether he is wounded in a training situation, in a friendly fire situation, or in a combat situation, he is eligible to receive disability pay and medical care from the Veterans Administration in any of those cases. So I looked at the number of total, what the Veterans Administration calls non-mortally wounded. And they put out a publication which looks at this number for every war, every U.S. war going back to the Revolutionary War. And the number on that sheet indicated that there were 50,508 U.S. soldiers who had non-mortal wounds. Now, that in turn came from a Department of Defense website which showed that there were about 47,000 non-mortal casualties in Iraq and about 6,000 in Operation Enduring Freedom, which is Afghanistan. I wrote this in my paper, footnoting it extensively to the source. And then after my paper was published, I received a phone call from the Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Defense, asking me where I had found these numbers. So I faxed him the material that came from his own website, and then the next thing I knew, I was informed by a number of the veterans organizations that the Pentagon had actually reduced the number on the veterans and its own website so that the more mild injuries that didn't require actual medical airlifting out of the region were no longer included.
But they themselves, it wasn't just you being very careful in counting these figures. They themselves had included them the month before, and you exposed that they had lowered the number and taken those casualties out.
Well, it's really very straightforward, because if you look at what the official statistics are for deaths in Iraq, for example, there are about 3,080 deaths to date, and that includes both hostile and non-hostile deaths. So when I was looking to do my paper, and again, the purpose of my paper was simply to estimate and project forward the cost to the VA of taking care of wounded soldiers, I looked at hostile and non-hostile wounded numbers. Now, the Pentagon has said that is a mistake and that we should be looking only at the number wounded essentially in combat situations. But I think that obviously when you look at the number who have been wounded in the war, there is a range of wounds from extremely severe wounds to mild wounds and injuries, as well as people who have collapsed from heat stroke or had bad reactions from an anthrax vaccine or a wide range of other conditions that have occurred while on active duty. Now, the question is, where do you draw the line in terms of what numbers the public sees? Certainly, from my perspective as an academic, the right number to use is the number that looks at the full cost of taking care of all soldiers with injuries.
Professor Vilmas, can you talk about mental illness and soldiers, post-traumatic stress disorder, how these soldiers who are coming home are being dealt with?
Well, Amy, there are over 200,000 soldiers who have come home so far who have gone to the Veterans Health Administration and sought medical care. And of those 205,000, 36%, so more than a third, have sought help for mental health conditions, which includes PTSD, substance abuse, acute depression, and other mental health conditions. And this is a much higher number than in previous wars and much higher than the VA had been anticipating. So what has happened is that there is a waiting list in many VA facilities and at many of the neighborhood vet centers for treatment. So you have a situation where it's simply a supply and demand situation. There are not enough mental health professionals to provide rapid care to all of those who are seeking it. And if I can say a word for a minute about these vet centers, one of the best things that the VA has done in recent years is to set up these veteran centers, which are neighborhood walk-in clinics, very low cost, that provide counseling and reintegration assistance for the veterans and their families. They are very easy to get to. They are not downtown, and they are a place where a wife, for example, can go in, or a parent if their son or husband is not the same since coming home. But these vet centers, and there are 207 of them around the country, have, in addition to the 200,000 who have sought medical care, 144,000 veterans have gone to the vet centers. Which is great that they exist, but they are overwhelmed. And a recent study commissioned by Congress shows that 40% of them are doing suboptimal mental health care. They're either putting people on waiting lists or they're taking soldiers who really require individual therapy and treatment and counseling and putting them into group counseling sessions and that sort of thing. So I think a real priority for Congress is to increase the funding for these veteran centers.
Linda Bilmes, you also co-authored the big report on the overall costs of war with Professor Joseph Stiglitz, formerly of the World Bank, now at Columbia. Can you talk Right. about these overall costs and what you estimated to cost?
Well, we estimated that the total cost of the war, including the budgetary and the economic cost and the long-term cost, would exceed $2 trillion. Which at the time, and that was only a year ago, seemed high, but it's seeming rather low now. I think that the important point that we were showing in our study is that in addition to the running costs, the numbers that you see in Washington, which are the $500 billion that we've spent already on the war, those are cash costs. Of feeding the troops and paying combat pay and enlistment bonuses and paying contractors and so forth. But even if we walked out tomorrow, even if everyone came home tomorrow, there are substantial long-term costs of the war, which include taking care of veterans, as I've just discussed, replenishing the military, replacing all of the equipment, retraining the military, resetting the military to its pre-war strength, and long-term costs, structural increases in the Defense Department. I mean, for example, the cost of enlistment bonuses, re-enlistment bonuses, the number of recruiters, and the combat pay, the amount of life insurance that we pay to families of those who have been killed, all of those have increased substantially. And those are not going to go down. Those are costs that are here to stay. So if you take just the long-term cost, that actually doubles the cost of just the cash running cost of the war. And then in addition, there are costs to the economy that the government does not bear. For example, there are many reservists and National Guards who have been in the war now for a year or 2 years, and they get paid less than what they would get paid in their civilian jobs as police officers and first responders. And there are costs that economists denote for example, the loss of a life of a prime age young person. And there are macroeconomic impacts, such as the effect on the price of oil.
I want to thank you, Linda Bilmes, for joining us, lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of the study, Soldiers Returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, looking at the long-term costs of providing veterans medical care and disability benefits. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Just got word from Washington, said the war is over and done, and the death count continues to rise. Halliburton got his share, And Cheney says it's fair and square. Besides, Brown Root's already there. Look beneath this broke down truck, sitting like a sitting duck. My hands are shaking, I cast my eyes to the sky. Bullets flying around my head, Kevlar vest is stained all red. Oh God, I don't wanna die. I see your eyes, I hear your voice, saying there's no other choice. Can't believe all your lies. Tell you about this bloody war. There's oil underneath the desert floor, and the death count just keeps getting higher.
Jimmy Lee Cole, The War Song, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House won an early victory Monday in the congressional debate over the Iraq War. Republicans blocked voting on a non-binding resolution expressing disapproval of President Bush's deployment of at least 21,000 more troops. The measure would have marked the first congressional effort since the invasion to confront President Bush over the war. Joseph Lieberman, the independent from Connecticut, joined with the Republican filibuster. Republicans Susan Collins of Maine and Norm Coleman of Minnesota switched sides and voted with the Democrats. As the Senate debated, a coalition of peace activists launched their own effort to oppose the war. 10 people were arrested occupying the offices of the staunchly pro-war and likely presidential hopeful Senator John McCain. The activists sang the names of 75 service members from McCain's home state of Arizona and chanted, "We remember you." The action is part of a new campaign called the Occupation Project, a campaign of sustained nonviolent civil disobedience to end the Iraq War. It's being led by the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Activists have promised to occupy offices of lawmakers who refuse to pledge to vote against additional war funding for the occupation of Iraq. My next guest is Executive Director of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Kathy Kelly, a veteran peace activist, just returned from 2 months living and working with Iraqi refugees in Amman, Jordan. She was one of those who was arrested in McCain's office and was released from jail just hours ago. Kathy Kelly joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Kathy.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you tell us exactly what happened yesterday and why you targeted Senator John McCain?
Well, we came to Washington, D.C. to be with companion groups Code Pink and Vets for Peace and the Military Families Speak Out, the Iraq Veterans Against the War, United for Peace and Justice. There's a long list, really, of people who are wanting to join together in a campaign called the Occupation Project. And also in Chicago, four people were arrested in Senator Barack Obama's office, four people in Senator Durbin's office. And we're aware of affinity groups that are organizing all around the country for this sustained campaign to make sure that the elected representatives know that we won't go away on this issue, that we won't be fooled by issues that are raised that would continue the spending for 3, 4, 5 years into the future. We want this funding turned off now. The United States waged a war of choice, and people in the United States don't, by and large, experience the consequences of this war unless they themselves have been bereaved because their loved ones were killed over in Iraq or come back maimed or sometimes psychologically destabilized. But certainly over in Iraq and in neighboring countries, Jordan and Syria, that have been burdened by a huge influx of people who have fled from Iraq, these people are experiencing consequences, and United States military escalation has very little relevance to the security of Iraq today.
Kathy, you say that you also, people occupied the offices of Barack Obama in Chicago.
Yes, that's true. You know, there is so much to admire in Senator Obama's vision and his desire to become a leader on behalf of solving problems with common sense in the United States. that we don't see any sense to continuing to pour money into the pockets of war profiteers, of major corporations that have benefited from this war. You know, military analysts have said that they're not worried about what the Democrats will do because they feel certain that in terms of the next elections, the Democrats aren't going to want to offend or defy the great giant military corporations. I'm thinking about Boeing and Lockheed and General Dynamics and Raytheon. But we are insisting that if the U.S. people who themselves have given mandates to elected leaders that they don't want to see this war continue, that they can see through the ruse of continuing to sustain corporate military growth at the expense of so many people's lives, including lives in the United States. If we continue to express this directly and clearly through nonviolent civil disobedience, we believe that elected leaders with conscience will pay attention.
Just practically in Washington, once you're arrested in a senator's office like you were in John McCain's office, how do you get back in and go to other people's offices and get arrested?
Well, you know, in some ways we might almost call this the peaceful assembly project. Congress shall make no law that abridges the right of people to assemble peacefully for the redress of grievance. We have a grievance. And the people who have suffered from this war have a terrible, terrible, almost unbearable grievance. So certainly people are allowed to go into those offices to sit down. They pay for those offices to exist and to dramatically present to the elected representatives our grievance by virtue of just listing the names. We'd have to be there for months and months to list all of the grievances that have happened because of this war. There's no security official that can stop you from entering the office of your elected representative.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly. She just got arrested in the offices of Senator John McCain of Arizona, part of the Occupation Project. She's actually just come back from Amman, Jordan. Kathy, who has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, has been to Iraq many times. Kathy, can you talk about your work in Jordan?
Much of the work in Jordan is simply listening, trying to understand better what the cares and concerns are of people who meant us no harm but who are completely trapped in Jordan and in Syria. I think the Human Rights Watch report that was issued toward the end of 2006 entitled The Silent Treatment did a great deal to stir up the waters and raise concerns for people, but there hasn't been any significant change in the situations of well over 750,000 Iraqis who've entered Amman, Jordan, and other major cities in Jordan, and 850,000 in Syria. These are conservative estimates. And these are people who, simply many of them, have no recourse, have no means to continue to sustain their families. And they're caught in a terrible catch-22. The United States had insisted that Iraq issue well over 1 million S-series passports, and then just weeks ago declared all of those passports invalid for travel into the United States. Now the UK has followed suit, and Jordan is now saying that those passports aren't valid. There's a concern that there were forgeries, and no doubt there were. Now everyone is supposed to get a G passport. If an Iraqi leaves Jordan, they can't get back into Jordan. They're also told they can only stay for 3 months in Jordan unless they've achieved permanent residency. These are people with no legal rights, no health care, no right to send their children to school. And many of them are running out of food, running out of ability to pay any kind of rent. And they're living under miserable circumstances. I've seen it in numerous families. And yet, rightfully, every non-governmental organization concerned for Iraq will tell you, look, the major, major problem, and the UNHCR also says this, is that of internally displaced people within Iraq. And it's become a humanitarian crisis to the extent that people are dying of hunger. It's cold in that part of the world right now. And people don't have fuel. They don't have blankets. They've moved in with communities that are trying to sustain them who didn't have enough potable water or food in the first place. There should be massive convoys of relief pouring into Iraq. And you know, the amount of money that the United States has devoted to humanitarian relief, not controlled by the U.S. military, is 0.01% of what the United States spends on war in Iraq. One man, Rafiq Shannon, the head of the International Organization for Migration, said very ironically to me, you know, if they just moved it up to 1% of that sum. It could even make a difference for U.S. security, because the people who are joining these militias are often young people who can't find a job. Iraq now has 50 to 75% unemployment. The only way to even get a pittance, a meager pittance of food and relief for one's family, is to join up with these militias. So it would have an impact on the security. So we aren't saying in the occupation project, leave Iraq to fend for itself, not by any means, but take this obscene, bloated military budget and direct that money toward paying just reparations and toward reconstruction not under the control of the United States military. The United States military has almost no relevance toward security in Iraq and actually jeopardizes much of the reconstruction work, as little as there is going on at all.
Kathy Kelly, I wanted to turn for a moment to a brief report we have from Jordan, from Democracy Now! Producer Jen Utes, who has been in Amman covering the plight of Iraqi refugees. She filed this report.
Ashraf Altai is a freelance journalist who worked as an interpreter for NBC in Iraq. He was kidnapped twice and was both mentally and physically tortured. He told me he's certain that if he returns to Iraq, he will be killed.
I'm under threat because I worked with Americans, because I had, in a way, connection with the Americans and the coalition forces. I used to go out on embeds. Many people saw me out with the U.S. Army shooting them on the streets.
Ashraf has been in Amman since June, and his tourist visa is about to expire.
Well, after my visa runs out, so I'm just going to hide in my apartment and wait something to happen, because I can't go out in the streets. Because if the police stop me and ask me for passport, and they're going to see that I'm illegally in the town, they're going to just depart me. And also, not only that, they're going to stamp on your passport that you are not allowed to enter Jordan for 5 years. And they're going to throw me and my family on the border.
Ashraf says he also worries about his financial situation.
I've been with no job for almost a year, and I'm married, so just spending the little money that I got from Iraq, working in Iraq, it wasn't that great money. Probably I can survive for another 2 or 3, 4 months. I have to find a job. It's very hard to get a job in here, and I don't think my problem will be solved in the next 4 months.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees is urgently appealing for $60 million to help meet the needs for the most vulnerable Iraqi refugees. Right now, Ashraf Altai has food. He has health. But soon he will run out of money. Soon, food and health may become a priority for Ashraf, just as it has for so many thousands of other desperate Iraqi refugees.
I think the United States and British government are the main reasons behind all the problems in Iraq, and they should help the Iraqi people, especially those who helped working with coalition forces or work with Americans and help them in Iraq.
From Amman, Jordan, this is Jen Utes for Democracy Now!
And we thank Jen for that piece. Kathy Kelly, your final comment and your plans as you have returned from Jordan now and are in Washington, D.C.
Well, I certainly look forward to rejoining my friends in Chicago for a sustained campaign at the offices of Barack Obama and Senator Richard Durbin. And I am hopeful that people all across the United States who worked so hard to prevent this war in 2003 during these very weeks of buildup toward that war in 2003, people came closer than ever before to stopping a war before it started. We're full tilt into that war, but our accountability, our responsibility hasn't lessened at all. And I hope that our major priority will be the poorest, the most precarious situations in Iraq, those of people who meant us no harm and to whom we have a grave responsibility to end the war.
Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, also one of the founders now of the Occupation Project, an 8-week-long campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience to end funding for the Iraq War. And speaking of Barack Obama, when we come back, we'll look at the record of this presidential candidate. Stay with us.
Oh. أبات ليلي نحيل الجسم أبات ليلي أبات ليلي ليلي أبات ليلي نحيل الجسم يا خلق يا خلق يا خلق يا خلق يا خلق يا خلق أنا الذي جلبت البلاء بيداي جبت العجارب على شفي وعضني ليش يا زماني ليش يا بكسر الخواطر كل ساعة ليه
I'm Ertalfik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Of the 10 candidates now in the Democratic presidential field, none have attracted more recent controversy than Senator Barack Obama. But that controversy has been unique and perhaps unprecedented for one reason. Almost without exception, Obama didn't do anything to start it. Just days after he entered the presidential race, Fox News picked up a false story that Obama attended an Islamic madrasa school as a child in Indonesia. CNN was earlier forced to apologize after displaying an image that listed Osama bin Laden's first name as Obama. Pundits have spoken at length over whether Obama's middle name, Hussein, will be a political liability. And last week, Senator Joseph Biden attracted widespread criticism after calling Obama, quote, the first mainstream African-American who's articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy. Obama has also gotten some welcome attention. He's been profiled in lengthy articles in several major publications, the New York Times, the Washington Post, cover articles in both Time and Newsweek. But amidst all the controversy and attention, very little has been said about Obama's stance on the issues. Today, we try to undo the spin with two guests. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Lynn Sweet has been closely following Obama's political career. She joins us from Washington, D.C., where she's the Chicago Sun-Times bureau chief. Salim Wakil is on the phone with us from Chicago. He's senior editor at In These Times, a weekly op-ed columnist for the Chicago Tribune. His latest piece is called Barack's Black Dilemma, and it's online at inthesetimes.com. Lynn Sweet, you've been following Senator Barack Obama for a long time. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of his history in politics and in the legislature as well?
Started its first elected office, state senate. After a few years there, he went to run for a House race that he lost to Congressman Bobby Rush, went back to the state senate. A short time after that, started the 2004 Senate race, had a big multiple-person primary, won it in a set of fluke circumstances that played to his advantage. In a general campaign, once again, had some fluke circumstances where the nominated candidate was replaced by Alan Keyes, much to his advantage. And so Barack Obama arrived in Washington, being sworn in January 05. Now, stop me when you want me to stop, if I could go into his first year in the Senate briefly.
Yes, go ahead.
Let me do international, and then we'll go to domestic. He did his first year's mark, the first 2 years in terms of the international. He's made three big trips, a multi-nation trip to Africa that I went with him on in August and September. He visited briefly Israel and Iraq before that, and then he made a swing to Russia and other former Soviet republics. He's a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he has a portfolio, therefore, to do this kind of travel, one of his big interests, which actually segues in a very interesting way with his multinational, multicultural background. On the domestic front, he's a member of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and just as he came to office was the same time that the Sun-Times ran a big series about how veterans across the nation were shortchanged on their benefits, and that was a good intersection for a story that gave him a very big sense of purpose and direction to grab onto and work to on veterans' benefits that immediately vaulted him to dealing with Senator Durbin on these mega issues dealing with benefits and the micro part of the issue, which is how they related to Illinois veterans. He's also then, at the end of his first year in January of 06, he was given the ethics spokesman portfolio by the Senate Democrats, and he took that on. Meantime, he also had tried to make some inroads dealing with hydrogen cars and energy and some other related matters. He also, in the wake of the Hurricane Katrina, he made a big move for a chief financial officer to be named to try and somehow deal with the hemorrhaging costs that were associated with cleaning up Katrina that never went directly or even indirectly to some of the people. So this is a very, very short thumbnail of some of the issues and matters that Senator Obama has been involved in.
Lynn Sweet, his first vote when he became a U.S. senator.
His first vote was, because you probably have it in front of you, I believe it was, he did not vote with, was it on the Ohio resolution?
Yes,
okay. That was interesting because if you were making a guess by, if the pass on that one was prologue, you would have thought he would have voted to taking the same position that many people in the House did. I believe it was only Barbara Boxer and himself that took that. I think that was a cue that he was going to start out pragmatic, slow, and not perhaps be a doctrinaire progressive where he might be predictive, where you might be easily to predict how he would go. He asked at the time for a little time, a little space. He didn't want to be boxed in. Needed to work his way around the Senate, he said. And didn't want to, and now I'm not quoting him, but my analysis at the time was he didn't want to marginalize him by going out in the limb on issues that had no chance of passing anyway.
And explain what the Ohio resolution was that he wasn't supporting.
That was a matter taken up after the controversial vote in Ohio in 2004. And, you know, I don't have it in front of me, so I don't want to mislead it. It wasn't asking for a recount. It was somehow addressing some the grievances that stemmed from the election, and forgive me, I don't have the wording in front of me, so I don't want to even, make any more statements about it because I don't know, I cannot remember the intricacies of it. But it was controversial, so as was his early vote to confirm Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Some people thought that because he was so strongly against the war, therefore he would vote against anyone and anything having to do with it. But the Obama that a lot of people did not really know well at the time is that he had his own views on separation of powers, basically giving the president his due and using a very gentle touch in the advice and consent part of what a senator does, certainly early on.
Lynn Sweet, I wanted to also bring in Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times and weekly op-ed columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Your latest piece is called Barack's Black Dilemma. What is that?
Well, it's a dilemma, really, that faces any black candidate who aspires to a position beyond the confines of the traditional black community. He has to appeal to a larger electorate while not alienating his core, and Barack has had to face that, his entire political career, essentially, and it's intensified now because he's aspiring for a higher office, and so that's basically it. He's being called to task for, he falls into this mold that arouses suspicion automatically in a lot of in much of the black community. He's he's clean, as Joseph Biden said. What Joe Biden meant by that, of course, is that he's not tainted by the kinds of traditional civil rights grievances that many other candidates are tainted with, and so he appeals to a wider audience automatically because of that. But at the same time, that makes him suspect to many African Americans because they've learned to be suspicious through a very hard-earned history to be suspicious of the slave master's favorite blacks, and Barack comes across sometimes as that. And so he arouses those kinds of cultural suspicions.
I wanted to go for a minute to Senator Biden's comments. This is what he said in an interview that was recorded by the New York Observer.
I mean, you got the first sort of mainstream African American who was articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy. I mean, that's a storybook, man.
Yeah.
Again, that was Senator Joseph Biden, and that came out on the day that Senator Biden announced his own presidential intentions, calling Barack Obama the first mainstream African-American who's articulate, bright, and clean, and a nice-looking guy. I mean, that's a storybook man. Biden later, in a conference call, tried to explain his remarks.
My mother has an expression, clean as a whistle, sharp as a tack. That's the context. He's crisp and clear.
President Bush also raised some eyebrows when he echoed part of Senator Biden's remarks. Speaking to Fox News, President Bush called Obama, quote, attractive and articulate. Salim Wakil, your response.
Well, you know, African Americans are not expected to be able to speak the King's English articulately. And when they do, that makes them exceptional. That's really an old story, and most African Americans are aware of where that's coming from. The reason why it raised so many hackles is because Biden seemed to be dismissing people like Al Sharpton and Reverend Jesse Jackson and Shirley Chisholm, and I think that's why when Barack Obama made his response to Senator Biden, he made sure to include the fact that Sharpton and Jesse were indeed quite articulate.
Lynn Sweet mentioned Barack Obama's loss to Bobby Rush when he first ran for Congress. What was the significance of that, and why do you think he lost, Salim Wakil?
Pardon me, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The question of one of the first losses of Barack Obama was to Bobby Rush, and the significance of that race.
Well, I think that Bobby Rush successfully employed that suspicion that I talked earlier about. At the time, Barack was a state senator, and he had kind of raised some hackles at the time because he challenged a very popular state senator at the time, Alice Palmer, who was progressive, and Barack seemed to come from nowhere to challenge her. And so there was some suspicions within the black community about Barack Obama at the time, and Bobby Rush successfully employed those suspicions to help him maintain his office in the first district.
Lynn Sweet, you one of your most recent pieces, seeking to solidify African-American backing for Barack Obama's presidential bid. Illinois Senate President Emil Jones Jr. told black Democrats meeting in Washington last week they don't owe anyone, alluding to but not mentioning by name Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton.
This is interesting because the Emil Jones, who is considers Barack Obama his son, his political son, very, very close to him. So at the Democratic National Committee winter meeting last week, he goes to the Black Caucus meeting and he says, you know, support our son. You don't owe anybody anything. So this is interesting because it is a race-based appeal. And word of this got out in the Politico. And I did a follow-up interview with Emil Jones yesterday, and I think he says he said what he said because it was a matter where he thought that the black community, political community, especially within the top tiers of the Democratic Party, needed to unite around Barack Obama. So here's what's interesting here. CNN then picked up the story and did an interview yesterday with Reverend Al Sharpton. Now, Sharpton met with Obama a few weeks ago, as he did with Hillary Clinton, and some of the other candidates on the Democratic side. He intends to meet with all of them. And he was a little noncommittal. He said he basically wanted to know what the urban agenda was for all the candidates. So put that aside. We're back to yesterday. CNN is discussing this with Al Sharpton in his interview, and he thinks that this is a little bit of dangerous ground to go into for State Senator Jones, because then, he raises the question, Barack Obama supported Mayor Daley. He's up for re-election in Chicago in a few weeks. And after all, Mayor Daley is running against two African-American candidates, and Barack Obama didn't support them. So how could you, he raises the question, expect unity within the community? And also, even saying the community is wrong, no, just as many other ethnic, religious, racial communities in America, there's not one monolithic group. However, when you talk about the Democratic National Committee, you're talking about a fairly small group of the elite activists. So this is interesting because Sharpton was ready on a dime to turn the table, and he was the moderating voice on this one, saying maybe you don't want to play that card at this time because Obama might not be able to pass the test that Emil Jones is putting down for him.
Salim Wakil, the significance of Senator Obama announcing his presidential bid in Springfield, Illinois?
Allude to the great emancipator and make the point that he doesn't really need that much experience to be considered a credible candidate, as Lincoln was not that experienced. I think that's basically where he's coming from with that.
And where do you think this campaign is headed, Salim, as a longtime political analyst and observer?
I'm quite perplexed, quite frankly, by Barack's rise. The wind has been at his back, as Lynn Sweet pointed out. He ascended through the really freak implosion of two major candidates, Blair Hall and Jim Ryan, who both had spousal problems, and so he's been rising ever since in an amazing kind of phenomena, and I'm just watching it and a bit amazed by it, and I think that he is even a bit amazed by it. I don't think Barack had any intention to run for president, but the draft, this kind of popular draft, is really extraordinary, and he might just be just the kind of unlikely candidate to be so odd that he manages something historic. His middle name is Hussein, after all. I mean, that alone is an incredible happenstance. He's a senator with a middle name Hussein. So the sky is the limit, really.
And finally, Lynn Sweet, as you follow Barack Obama, interesting piece in The Nation, Christopher Hayes talking about David Axelrod, the 51-year-old reporter turned media consultant, key media strategist for both Deval Patrick, the new governor of Massachusetts, and Senator Obama.
And Rahm Emanuel and Mayor Daley and a string of other mayors and political figures. There is a core group of people around David who will also be active in the campaign, who will build the infrastructure of the Obama campaign. The campaign manager for Barack Obama, for example, is one of David's partners. So you can say that David is not only one of his closest advisors, but his firm is going to be centrally involved in the campaign too.
Lynn Sweet and Salim Wakil, I want to thank you both for being with us. Lynn Sweet is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. Salim Wakil is Senior Editor at In These Times and a weekly op-ed columnist for the Chicago Tribune. We thank you both for being with us as we wrap up today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Yutes, Anna Nagera, and Arata Bhagwati. Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Nagera are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks also to Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Peter Yoon, John Randolph, Jerome Bourgeois, Samantha Chambly. I'll be in Melbourne, Florida on Saturday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.